You're listening to Soccer Report Extra with Bobby McMahon and Owen O'Callaghan.
Welcome to the Soccer Report Extra World Cup special podcast. We're now down to the last eight, and I don't know about you, Owen. Oh yes, Owen O'Callaghan's with us, and at the controls is producer Luke Crawford. But I don't know if I'm going to get through this, Owen. After watching even just down to two games a day, I'm mentally wiped.
I think somebody said it today, even the shit games are brilliant.
Yeah. Like I'd, you know, I know nostalgia plays a big role in our, as we older we get, you know, the more we, remember that year, that was a great World Cup. Honest to God, I think it's getting better. I think it was better in Brazil, and I think it's absolutely been terrific in Russia.
This is an astonishing tournament. I think the level of drama and tension, even after the first lot of group games, you know, I mean, we had some of those opening rounds in the groups that were just enthralling to watch. One goal games, you know. Yeah. People were complaining at the start of the tournament about how many games are ending 1-0, but you were actually looking and saying, yeah, but out of those games, how much value for money were you getting? You know, it was just end-to-end stuff. It was edge of your seat. There was you know, normally it was a smaller nation competing, and you know, who was really a fan favorite, you were really urging to try and get a result if they could. You know, probably the mind goes back to Peru Denmark as a good example of that sort of game. And from there, the drama has just escalated. We've had major shocks. We've had big teams eliminated. We've had goal fests in the knockout stages. We've had penalty shootouts. We've had absolute thrillers. We've had last-minute winners. We've had incredible comebacks. And we've not even started a quarterfinals yet.
No. When you look at, you know, look at the 56 games so far, definitely less than the fingers on one hand are the number of games I could say, yeah, probably... Oh, probably that was a bit of a waste of time. You know, they've just been so few. There's been so many twists, as you pointed out. And, of course, now we're in the knockout round. We've got the drama of extra time, the drama of seeing three times in the round of 16 to go to penalty kicks as well. It just keeps on coming. The only, and I know I'm getting ahead of myself here, but what happens in 2026 now when they go to 48 teams?
Well, it just, I mean, to the thing, yeah, I mean,
is it a case of, you know, is that an overreaction thinking it's going to get watered down so much, or is there a threat that FIFA could be sort of killing the goose that lays the golden egg?
Well, I think that there's, you know, we'll probably get into this in later podcasts in more depth, but I do think that the one refreshing aspect of this tournament has been the parity between the teams that we just have not seen at club level. You know, obviously a lot of our listeners to the podcast will watch Champions League midweek, and economically the odds are just so heavily stacked, you know, against the little club that could, you know, they reach the knockout stages or maybe quarterfinals and that's it. There's so few romantic stories. Whereas at this tournament particularly, and you have got that in World Cups as well, you know, normally the cream tends to rise to the top, and yes, there may be the odd surprise in every edition of the tournament, but I have never seen, and yes, people will immediately refer to the Panama-England game, but with that again, or the Russia-Saudi Arabia, with those two results put to one side, the closeness in terms of the results, particularly in the group stage, was really, really rewarding. You know, it was a kind of a heartwarming aspect of this tournament. And I think
much closer when you if you sat down and analysed the likes of the Premier League or any of the major leagues in Europe, or even MLS for that case, and analysed them over 56 games, you would find more than two blowouts.
Oh, completely. And I think as well, even within the results, you know, you had so many games turning on the thinnest of margins. You know, you had certain groups where, you know, you wouldn't begrudge Iran or Morocco or Peru reaching the knockout stages. Senegal, obviously eliminated in a tiebreaker situation. You had maybe Nigeria could feel that on another day they would have got through. So, you know, I think that when you look at this tournament, that's one of the major, major exciting elements of it, where you had those teams that weren't there to just kind of, you know, say hello to their fans and wave at their family in the crowd. They actually kind of took part on the field and they were there or thereabouts. And every game, bar maybe the two that I've referenced, you know, were really, really exciting. And that's really been a great thing. And it's the worry going forward when you expand the tournament to, and everything gets bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, when you have something and when you have the magic chemistry in a bottle, you want to keep it like that. You want to put it on the shelf and say, right, let's just have it stay like that for as long as we can, because it's obviously, it's just the right blend of everything. And yeah, maybe it is inexplicable, the kind of moment that we're in right now. Maybe there is a kind of a something remarkable that's happening just for this particular edition of a World Cup. But I think the size of it, I think everything works. And I think looking further down the line, I think you're going to change that. And then obviously everything changes as a result.
Yeah, it's interesting, because if you look at the technical ability, you know, it's kind of this old thing, or you know, people will turn around and tell you, well, I only watch good football, I only watch good soccer, I only watch the Premier League, I only watch this, I only watch that, right? You notice how I threw that one in. But the reality is international football at one time was the best football. The teams we saw at the World Cup were the best in the world, because they were all-star teams. They were clearly, you know, from that country, they were the equivalent of all-star teams, as I would say, in North America. But as and I guess you'd go back to the Bosman ruling as being a kind of genesis of this, as the big teams and the names with the teams with cachet began to, the dough started rolling in, and the ability through Bosman to sign players in a lot freer way in the European Union, and a whole bunch of reasons that kind of coalesced, you started to find the mega clubs. And now you've got, if you want to see the best football in the world, you watch the Champions League. But just because it's the best, it doesn't make it the most dramatic, does it?
And as well, I think there's an element in this where not everybody can play for Real Madrid. So I think that in terms of the international game, what you also have is a little bit of, you know, it's almost a throwback to people having a shop window in which to perform in. You know, when you're at a Champions League level, the odds are so heavily stacked against you. You don't have the same level of opportunity to kind of grow in a tournament, or to, or you know, for that matter,
to catch lightning in a bottle and just feel its destiny.
Exactly, and I think that you know, in terms of Champions League, and I'm repeating this tournament. Obviously, that's kind of where the focus is in terms of the average football fan or whatever. It's a closed enough shop, right? It's Real Madrid, it's Barcelona, it's Juventus. It's a very, very tiny percentage of players that can now get to that level. That, you know, you even look at, you know, certain English teams, Manchester United players who play for Tottenham. All the, yeah, you're raking in money, but you're never getting to that level of domestic club football. Whereas you shift the narrative a little bit and you step onto something like a World Cup, there's almost an element of an FA Cup about this tournament. It's like, here's a chance for you to, like in an FA Cup situation, it's a chance for you to win silverware. It's a chance for you to experience something that's really positive, and it's really happy, and it's a bit kind of retro, and it makes people reminisce and be nostalgic. And in a similar way, a World Cup does that as well. I mean, you know, for a while there, the World Cup seemed to maybe arguably get lost. You know, there was a couple of tournaments that just seemed to bypass everyone as that shift happened between club football and international football. But I now think that we're at that stage where club football has got boring. It's kind of like that. The artist that just had the number one hit once in his life, and he just finds it really, really difficult to fucking repeat the trick.
With technology and coaching and the ability to learn and improve. And I don't want to overplay this because I'm not want to make this sound like suddenly the small countries have got an advantage. But one of the great equalizers I would suggest in terms of World Cup and European Championship that we're beginning to see, which is counter to kind of to what we would have expected, is there's actually to a degree an advantage for small countries because they've got settled squads and they haven't got so much choice. Like, so these coaches, the managers, are working with a very small number of players, but they can actually, because they have got so little choice, they've got the ability, I think, in some cases, and the chance in some cases, to almost create a team out of them, as opposed to if you look at the bigger nations, you look at a Belgium, you look at, you know, Belgium in this case, and France and Spain, and go on and on and on. And how many, you know, what's the difference between the 15th best player that's available to the Italians and the 30th best player available to the Italians? It's probably minuscule, right?
Yeah.
But if you go to Iceland, the difference between the 15th best player and the 30th best player is probably a difference between guy playing in the Bundesliga and the guy that starts for the pub team on Sunday.
And do you know what as well? I think I've noticed in this tournament, I began to notice it a lot this season, I think, for the last domestic season for clubs. I did a piece just before the FA Cup final with Gavin Peacock, who played for Chelsea and Newcastle and QPR. But I did a piece with him about the 1984 FA Cup final, and Manchester United beat Chelsea that day 4-0. Cantona scored two penalties. But Peacock, at 0-0, smacked a volley instinctively from about 25 yards and it crashed off the underside of the crossbar. And, you know, obviously games change in very, very minor incidents and all that sort of stuff. But when I then subsequently watched the cup final between United and Chelsea that weekend, there was a moment that happened in the game and I just turned to a buddy of mine I was watching the game with, and I said, the lack of instinct and individuality is completely gone. There is no more moment like Gavin Peacock turning a volley towards goal from 25 yards and it crashing off the bar. Now players are trained to take the ball down, take a touch, maybe take a second touch, recycle it, knock it, you know, across the pitch or knock it behind them and build an attack from there. They're not encouraged to take the game by the scruff of the neck and actually express themselves in a club game, because there's obviously so much there. There's a risk involved. At this World Cup, yep, I think what we are seeing as well in terms of even the goals being scored is maybe a reaction to these players and what happens to them in a club environment. And I'm not going to say let off the leash a little bit, because obviously you have to still be, you know, you have to play the percentages, you know, even probably more in World Cup situation. But there seems to have been a refreshing nature to this tournament that I'm wondering, could it be a reflection of how these players from day to day with their clubs are kind of being instructed and being directed and being trained, and maybe, you know, overcoached, robotic. You know, obviously there's been such a turnaround in terms of how football is being played now that a lot of teams will you know, have that slow build up, patient build up, and that the energetic, turn on a sixpence and shooting towards the corner from 25 yards doesn't tend to happen as much as it used to do anymore.
But it's interesting, and we'll get back to the World Cup in 2 minutes. We'll just we'll probably close this down for the end of the first segment of the show. But you're touching on something that's kind of rattled around my head for a little while as well, is the aspect of coaches and academies and the production of young players, whether it be in North America, whether it be in Europe, wherever it be. Is the reality is everybody's trying to do the same thing. Mm. Like, everybody's coaching the same way. And you need, I think, you know, there's going to be, whether it's there now, maybe, you know, maybe to some extent Pep is is one of the exceptions. That Mourinho was maybe an exception to that as well. Is but the way that you and I can think of another couple of examples off the top of my head, but to actually make an impact, somebody's got to have the guts to be different than everybody else. You've got to say, well, if there's 17 teams in the league and they're all playing this way, well, if I just play that way, then I'm just the same. I have nothing different to bring to it. But if I can, you know, it's almost like back to the Greece 2004, winning the European Championship, I should say, in Portugal. They did that by playing a system that hadn't been used for years because everybody else was playing pretty much the same systems.
Like I think there was a good example of it in the knockout stage. I think on one hand you had something like Spain, you know, Spain taking on Russia. Spain could not be any more rigid and robotic.
They could not change.
They had no person on that pitch who felt confident or felt trusted enough to drop a shoulder, go past the player, and from 18 or 20 yards, once he hit the edge of the box, to just fancy his chances at putting it in the top corner.
If you go through that, Owen, and it's not just, I think Spain's a great example of that, but I think the one thing, and I kind of criticise, if there's one negative in the World Cup, it's there are a lack of players that can disrupt other teams.
True. The contrast that I was about to make was the Belgium-Japan game. And in two situations there, you had the Japanese already being one up, and not just remarkably being 1-0 up and thinking to themselves, Christ almighty, we're 1-0 up here. You actually had the second goal, which came from Kagawa, who fancied an effort, and then he just had second thought. He wanted to recycle, so he lays the ball off. And from 20 yards out, Inoue has a look and says, you know what, I'm taking this on, and absolutely belts it. Nestles in the corner.
You know what he said at that point? In we go.
I should have seen that coming. But to complete that point, the Belgian winning goal, which goes from penalty area to penalty area. I am not sure if there is or was another team in the competition who would have constructed a goal like that.
It was brilliant, wasn't it? It was an absolute piece of art.
Because in terms of even the mindset, pass, De Bruyne breaks the line, he's charging forward, you have a numerical advantage. But now, somebody like De Bruyne, you mentioned a lack of players in a tournament, so many players would have stopped, not taken the risk of playing a pass further forward, waited for support, checked it back to a central midfielder, knocks it to a fullback, and suddenly Japan get enough players back. And to actually take the risk to absolutely swarm forward with enough players, it was such a refreshing moment in a World Cup, and kind of in the just in terms of the image of where we are in terms of football right now, it was so different from what we've come to expect. And I think it's a little microcosm of this tournament, really. Just when you think that you know what to expect, something happens, and you think, well, thank God that that's actually taken place, because it kind of just gives you a bit of a pep, and it gives you a bit of excitement, and it makes you feel good. And ultimately, that's what we're all here for.
Yeah, and to say nothing of an equaliser with Fellaini header, and Vertonghen with the
and
most
a fluke.
Unbelievable headers I've never seen anything like that in my life. Never. Whether it was a fluke or not, it doesn't really matter, does it? It was unbelievable.
It was one of those, well, when your luck is in, I mean, when that goes in and drops over the keeper, drops inside the far post,
go by a
lot, I'm sure Japan people look at each other and go, oh, here we fucking go.
Anyway, that's us gone. We've killed, that's about 20 minutes for the first segment. We haven't got to the World Cup yet, or the World Cup last 8. So that's the end of the first segment. We'll be back in a second.
You're listening to Soccer Report Extra. Keep up to speed with the podcast and get all the latest news, musings, and rants from Bobby and Owen by liking us on Facebook at Soccer Report Extra. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. part two of the Soccer Report Extra podcast, World Cup edition, now into the last eight. So if you've been keeping tally at home, and I doubt very much if you have, I certainly wouldn't have, the current prediction scoreline is...
Oh, dear.
Owen scratched his way back, went five in a row up till today. So you're now sitting at 27-29, and I'm sitting at 29-27. With eight games left. So it's like I've got to break a serve, I think.
I think so.
But it's close.
I squandered my chance earlier on. I mean, you know, you took the first penalty and I got it back. I wrestled the advantage back from you, but now I think I've missed one and I've handed advantage back to you.
I've got that little prediction thing I did with the guy from Harvard on the Forbes column.
Yes.
I have got like one chance in a million of beating them, I think. Like, I've just had too many teams go by the wayside.
Like, and what's his prediction? How is his predictions lining up at the moment?
Well, he's going for Brazil. He went for Brazil to win it, beating Germany in the final. So he's got that on one side. But he's got France as well going deep. And obviously, I've lost Spain. You know, there's I've got Brazil going to the... had Brazil going to the final, but he's got them going to the final. He's got it winning. It's a whole bunch of stuff. It doesn't look good at the moment. I think the machine may win. Mm. But in the meantime, let's look at the last day, the 2018 World Cup finals. Let's go through them game by game, Owen.
Yes.
And it's probably as quickly as possible as well. And let's look at each of them and come up with a reason why each country could win the World Cup. And a reason why they won't win the World Cup. And let's see if we've changed our mind. I've certainly changed my mind because I'm quite categorical in my assertion that Spain will no longer win the World Cup.
I would join you. I do not think that Germany have what it takes at this stage of the tournament.
So let's start off the first game on Friday. It's a cracker. It's a cracker. This is so lopsided. You look at Uruguay, France, Brazil, Belgium on one side of the draw, and I think you can make a great case for any of these teams, any of these countries winning the World Cup.
Correct.
And then the other side, maybe not so much. But Uruguay, France. Why could Uruguay go in and win this World Cup?
I'll give you two reasons. My first reason is their defence. Absolutely astounding. Defies logic sometimes.
The golden blanket.
Just absolutely magnificent. But also, the kind of myth of Uruguay, you know, after the knockout round, you heard a lot about, look at them there, little Uruguay. You know, the population, they're such a tiny thing. You know, what are they even doing here? And you have to remind people that actually, when it comes to World Cups, they're not half bad. They kind of know what they're doing. Like, we've kind of known about their small population for a long time. They've actually won the fucking thing twice. You know, the Roll of Honour.
And the first time they won it, they're only about 40% of the population
they've moved. Yeah. You know, I mean, you know, they're a decent side, you know. But, you know, going by people's reaction, it's like, I don't know, Panama have got to the quarterfinals. So therefore, they also have a bit of noose. They have, they know their way around these parts. So there's two reasons for you. In terms of, do you want to do the reason why they won't win it, or?
Well, I'll come up with a reason why not. And although I'd really quite like them to win it, I've travelled a long road since not liking them in 2010. but Suarez, I thought, was terrific. Him and Cavani up front were absolutely terrific in the victory over Portugal. I think they're a far better team than they were in 2014. They may not be a better team than they were in 2010 because Forlan certainly made them tick at that point. But they've certainly, by that point, there were seven men back and three up in attack and no midfield. But they've got some nice wee players in midfield now as well. But I do get my giggles at Christian Rodriguez coming on, who is he just muscular or is he 50 pounds overweight?
I think that sort of question can be applied to many of the Uruguayan
team. He's just a big frame. Like, let's just say he's got a big frame. But ultimately, I think Uruguay will become undone because of their lack of depth. and particularly up front. Because if Cavani can't play against France, I don't know who they bring in to come even remotely close to being able to fill that role. And you know, the same goes with Suarez. If he's looking at, you know, another kind of performance that he put in against Portugal, he seemed to me to put an awful lot of mileage on these legs, and they are getting older. And I think it's depth that ultimately. But there again, on the other side, I could actually see Uruguay grinding out draws and being quite happy to go to penalty kicks as well. But on Friday, I will take France to go through 2-1.
I have taken France to reach the final. So I'm banking on them to get the better of Uruguay. I think the level of France's performance against Argentina should give them so much momentum heading into this. And I think they should be very, very aware that they won't get the same degree of space and the same degree of opportunity. But in saying that, I do think that they possess enough, a massive contrast, as you alluded to, in terms of depth, in terms of having enough people on the pitch to make something happen. So I think I would give France the nod as well in this one. I certainly do think it will be tight. And I think that both teams will score. So I think 2-1 is probably a decent bet as well.
Okay, so then we move on to they're pre-tournament favourites, and I guess they still are tournament favourites, as Brazil against Belgium. Let's start with Belgium first. The reason they can win this. I'll start off with the reason they can win it.
Sure.
And you can come up with the reason they can't. I just think they've got great depth. I was really impressed with coming back from 2-0 against Japan. Not just the fact they came back 2-0 and won it in normal time, but they did it without panicking. I thought it was really interesting that Martinez never made a change till about 13 minutes after that second goal went in. Mm. Like, he allowed the game to settle back in. He didn't disturb things. There was no sense of panic. Like, he made his double substitution. He brought the big man on. And Chadley beside him, Chadley down one wing, and Fellaini kind of pushing up from the midfield. But it wasn't the sense of panic substitution that I think a lot of coaches and a lot of managers would have done as soon as that second goal went in. So I think that was a real positive for them. And once, you know, they're kind of opposite of Uruguay, I look at the depth they've got in a number of positions. Boyata coming out, Vincent Kompany coming in his place. You look through their midfield. I don't come up with too many areas where they're short. And the thing is, apart from that, I was thinking actually at one point De Bruyne was going to get taken off because I thought he was having a brutal game up until that last minute, which goes to show you why you keep one of your best players on the field to the end if you're trying to win a game. And Hazard, I think, has just had a terrific tournament, and Lukaku has been up there as well. So I just think overall they're the real package, and I kind of have the feeling that even though I picked Brazil to win this game in the bracket, I don't think it's beyond a very good chance that Belgium could actually take Brazil.
One concern to Belgium that I would have, mentality. I think we've always known about their
two Belgian.
We've always known about the individual talent. We've always known about, you know, the conveyor belt and how much they have within that squad. But it feels that we've been kind of banging that drum for a while without ever really having them deliver. And to kind of back up all of the potential that's there. In facing a side like Brazil, what you have is really coming up against a team that haven't really had a glove laid on them in the tournament. It's kind of been relatively plain sailing for Brazil. I mean, even against Mexico, Mexico showed a bit of excitement, a bit of exuberance early doors. But outside of that, it was a very boringly professional job by Brazil. You always felt that they could easily notch it up a gear or two with the likes of Firmino coming off the bench. Willian was outstanding. You know, that's you know, in terms of the other players that can step up and deliver outside of the main headliners. You wonder, you know, even if Belgium were to take the lead, in terms of their ability to control that lead, you know, will they allow, you know, will they completely be able to shut the door on Brazil? So just in terms of this tournament, where they are facing a high profile opponent in Brazil, again, luck of a draw possibly comes into it. If, you know, if they got a nicer draw and, you know, possibly be on the other side of the draw, you know, at this stage and seeing how that would progress, maybe that would suit them better.
Well, there could have been if they'd beaten England.
Exactly, and there you go. It's these fine details, isn't it? Gareth Southgate's a genius after all.
But I think you can overdo that, and I think some of the points have been made. I think it was maybe Gary Neville that said in a tweet, or somebody said it in a tweet anyway, that if you're playing the World Cup, you're going to the World Cup. It's game. It's like playing exactly. against Brazil is the games you want exactly. to play in. And it's like there's I think there's maybe a little bit of feel similar to 2010 when the Dutch beat them 2-1 about this team. I'm
you're not convinced.
I think Brazil have got better. Yeah, I'm not convinced. I think they've got better, but I just don't think they're sparked yet. And I think this is going to be a hell of a match. I really do. I think this. Fingers crossed, but this could be an absolute, you know, one of the classics, not just of this World Cup, but one of the great games of all time. I know I'm overselling it already, but when I look at the players that are going to be on the park, I think it could be a cracking game.
All right, moving to Saturday.
So did we answer the question of why Brazil won't win the World Cup?
Well.
Because they're Brazil.
Because they're incredibly irritating. They've got emotional problems. Yeah. They've got an over reliance on a superstar. You know.
I don't think they're so reliant on continuous.
The question will remain whether or not Neymar's presence in this Brazilian team is a good thing or a bad thing. I think the focus on him for so much of every game is absolutely remarkable, and I'm not sure how it kind of goes down with his teammates. You know, even when he's kind of trying to blend as much into the background as he can, there are still these absolutely inexplicable incidents, and suddenly the attention is exactly where he wants it, which is at his feet. So I wonder, you know, particularly if this game goes against them, how much Neymar will feature in the post-elimination analysis.
How much will they miss Casemiro?
Yeah, it's a good point, actually.
Assuming that Fernandinho is going to be the player that will benefit from that.
Yeah, and usually that's the change. You know, Fernandinho has come on, hasn't he, the last couple of games, usually at the same time. It's that kind of, you know, automatic change. You know, he just slots in there, but it's traditional, isn't it, for Brazil to have a couple of those players who are very, very crucial to the approach, that do a lot of the donkey work. And, you know, like that as well, you change the chemistry.
Dunga, and was it 94, was it Mauro Silva, I think it was,
Riley there as well in 94, and they had a couple of guys. Gilberto Silva was there 2002, and Edmilson, yeah. You know, all those kind of guys should be relatively under control. I mean, you know, Fernandinho should slot in there. You know, they should be able to deal with it. Whether or not it's going to be a massive issue for them is another thing.
Couple of aging centre backs there, though,
who haven't really been tested, have they? As well,
no. And I'm just wondering, will Lukaku there? Whether Lukaku can maybe rumble them up, or whether we'll see the ultimate with Marouane Fellaini coming on again. With 20 minutes to go and getting the elbows up on them.
Isn't it funny how, you know, you think of the world's greatest and tactics and analysis and, you know, the forensics, and you send a fucking big man on and it's chaos.
See, I think you probably sense it, but I've always been a bit of a Fellaini fan. I realise that he stinks the place out at times.
But my favourite.
But I've also seen him dominate games as well.
But my favourite period of Manchester United over the last number of years was under Louis van Gaal, when United had the Liverpool game and the Manchester City game, and was it Arsenal as well in there? And he actually played Fellaini further forward, and as essentially as a target man, and everything else happening around them, and teams could not deal with him.
No.
And United beat Man City 4-2. It was, I think, the Juan Mata scoring twice at Anfield, Liverpool game. And they beat Arsenal as well. I can't remember what the scoreline was. But it was United playing really exhilarating football. And at the centre of it was Marouane Fellaini. So, you know, I think the criticism, you know, I think he's always thought of himself as being that kind of deep lying midfielder. And has always wanted to play that sort of role.
It's interesting. You go back to, we're getting a little bit sidetracked here, but going back to the Moyes days, right? The Moyes days of at Everton, like, he was pretty much a box to box midfield player at that point.
Was it the famous one? Was it the 4-4 that cost United the title, the Everton draw?
Yeah, but it was also the one at the beginning of that season as well, or beginning the 2012-13 season, I think it was. When it was the first game of the season. It was 12-13 because that was Ferguson's last year and they went on to win the league. They lost the first game of the season and Fellaini absolutely destroyed them. I think the game was at Goodison and it was 1-0. Fellaini scored as well. It was a Monday night game, I remember. He was absolutely brilliant. They could not combat him. No matter what they did, they were just bouncing off him. He was just absolutely brilliant that night.
So
anyway, what's your prediction for Brazil and Belgium? What's the score?
I think it could be Brazil in a shootout,
like 7-6.
Brazil, Belgium in a penalty shootout, something like, I don't know, 3-2. I mean, a 3-2 in a shootout. I think it's going to be. I think probably
3-2.
I think 1-1 maybe. After extra time,
1-1, and then Brazil on penalties.
I think so.
Okay. I have actually 3-2, but 3-2 Belgium.
Oof.
I'm replicating Italy, Brazil, 1982.
Goodness me.
Going out on a limb. What's the fun when your predictions have absolutely been destroyed? What's the point of being cautious?
Well, it's going to set up a pretty lovely Friday, isn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, so to Saturday now, and the two other teams we watched today, Sweden and England. So the Swedes do it. The Swedes have now finished ahead of the Netherlands in the group qualifying, even though they didn't beat them, lost once and drew once. They knock Italy out. They didn't knock Germany out, but they qualified ahead of Germany. And they're keeping on going. And I understand
always
why,
hated them.
But I'm going to say I don't understand why.
You need to eat your words now for all of our listeners in Sweden, because you've permanently had an issue with Sweden, even though they've given the world Volvo, IKEA, ABBA, so many great
Björn Borg,
like the list is endless. And
Zlatan.
You've always had an issue with them. So, I mean, you know... It's time for you to apologise to our Swedish community.
I've got to tell you a story. I know we're going off track here, but it was the Sunday, I think, Germany beat Sweden, wasn't it?
I forget. All of the days just roll into the one.
The 2-1, the cross, or Saturday or a Sunday. Maybe it was a Saturday. I think it was a Saturday, right? So my wife was going, you know, we've got to go to IKEA this weekend.
Brilliant.
We've got to go to IKEA. So I convinced her that it was not a good idea to do it when games were on, but we'd go straight as soon as the games were finished. So I went to IKEA, right? Walked out the truck, and the first thing we saw was a van with a German flag sitting right outside of IKEA. And I thought to myself, there the Germans go again. Like, their officials have mocked the Swedes after they beat them, and now they've sent their fans to IKEA to really take the piss.
Oh dear!
The depths that they will go to. So my apologies to Sweden.
And
they're a workmanlike team.
And you know, listen, we'll be absolutely jubilant for Sweden when they knock England out of the World Cup on Saturday morning.
What about here's one? What about Olsen? Is it Olsen the goalkeeper? I think it's Olsen, isn't it?
We can check that out. We're so well prepared on this podcast.
I think so. What about him? Yeah, what about him for the Golden Glove?
Well, I don't even know. How many have they conceded?
Well, they conceded 2 against Germany.
Okay.
And that's it.
Whew. And they won't be conceding any against England either. So, I mean, that would set them right up.
It's interesting, though, isn't it? Like, you look at the Golden Gloves, the Muslera, once again, we're off track here, but Muslera's got to be, you know, he's got to tick a few boxes in terms of that. Olsen in the Swedish goal, or we think it's Olsen in the Swedish goal.
I do believe it's Robin Olsen.
Oh, there we go. So we're pretty good. I didn't know his first name. Lloris, I think you discount Lloris because of the three goals against Argentina. That's a hard one to come back from. Becker, you know, could be in with shout. Courtois could be in with shout.
Akinfeyev
as well. Yeah, we haven't got to him yet though. But that's another one. Subasic, another one. It could be a very close battle here for the Golden Glove and Olsen. And have you seen a better centre back in this tournament than Granqvist?
He's been exceptional, isn't he?
He's been brilliant.
I've seen a couple of good games. In fairness, you know, there's been a couple of good defensive performances, but he has been exceptional. And it's weird because I feel bad. I really did not expect Sweden to get this far in the tournament. I really did not. I felt that Switzerland would do them in the knockout round. I thought that it would just be nipped in the bud. But this is working. This strategy has got them this far. To write them off against England would be absolute fallacy. And I think
Forsberg
as well...
finally had an impact on the game.
But also, the goals that they're scoring are just...
I know.
I mean... you have to admit that it's all very well having strong defensive units, but when you get good fortune up front, because they have nothing up front, they have nothing. I mean, who does Marcus Berg even play for these days? It feels like he's been around for so long.
He was in Germany at one point.
Is he in the Middle East? I have a feeling he's in the Middle East. Maybe Luke could check that. You know, Ole Toivonen, had that period when he was very good in Eredivisie, and he can't even get his game in France, I don't think.
But he went to Sunderland, so that was immediately puts his game in the crapper, right?
And yet,
where good players go to die.
Speaking of Sebastian Larsson, still doing the rounds there as part of that Swedish lineup. if you wanted,
so why? So what's the reason Sweden can't win the World Cup?
Well, we've just listed them.
Okay? What's the reason they can win the World Cup?
I think at this stage,
you can't discount anything.
Yeah, I was listening to Martinez after the Belgium game, and what he said was, you know, the reporter was asking him, listen, you've had a few hairy moments in the game. And he went, enough about Fellaini. He didn't say that. but what he did say was, listen, you know, yeah, for all the supporters, they've been great. We're at a knockout stage of the competition. All that matters is the result. All that matters is getting through. And Sweden lay the foundation. They say, right, we don't have anything in attack. Therefore, we're going to make things hard for a team to get through us. And that teams have found it really difficult to get a win against this team. You listed all of the qualification. Germany found it immensely tough. I mean, Marco Reus, the ball goes off his knee.
Italy never scored against them in two games, right?
Yeah,
gone three games out of four at the World Cup without conceding a goal.
Yeah, Reus bundles one in off his knee. Cruz has a moment of divine inspiration to stick it in the top corner. Outside of that, it's been heroic. The other thing about Sweden going to this game is the pressure is off. They have totally overachieved. They're in the final eight. Their whole country is just saying, what an amazing story this is. On the other hand, England, buoyed by the fact that they've eliminated Colombia, buoyed by the fact that they've finally won a penalty shootout, the country will be in such a fit of fucking hysteria between now and Saturday that they will be already looking ahead to a semi-final. Therefore, Sweden can also count on whatever degree, and I'm not saying it's going to be massive overconfidence in terms of the English players, but there will be a degree of confidence there, certainly. I think you add that to the mix, I think Sweden have a great chance in this game. And as you alluded to before we press record on this podcast, the history books tell us that England find it tough traditionally against this team.
Yeah. So are you going for Sweden or are you going for England?
Scotland. I am going for Sweden to win 2-1.
I'm going to follow my usual strategy. I'm picking England to win. And so if they lose, I'm just as happy. In fact, I'm happy.
The prospect of... To be honest, let's apologise to our listeners. Guys, you know the drill. You're listening to a podcast featuring a Scotsman and an Irishman. So if you are English, you should have really known what we were about to talk about here.
So I'm going 1-0 England. Harry Kane penalty.
Oh Christ, fuck off.
That's the most inventive I can get. How many penalties has he scored now?
Also, who else has fucking scored for them? Like, has anyone else stepped up to the plate except for John Stones?
Oh, but the Stones scored. Sterling scored a goal.
Lingard got one.
Yeah, pretty much Harry Kane from the penalty spot. And if they get to the final, you know how they're going to win this, don't you? Harry Kane from the penalty spot. So I'm going 1-0 Sweden.
It's
going 2-1 England.
So we've got... It's coming home. It's coming. Football's coming home.
I've never understood that.
It's infectious,
isn't it?
I've
never understood that. But anyway, that's a story for another day. So that brings us to the last game of the quarterfinal. Russia and Croatia. I have a theory that Russia continued to run right after this game and have continued to run non-stop since it. How the hell did they beat Spain? I know how they beat Spain. Spain kind of beat themselves.
Yeah, completely.
Like, the Rodrigo, when he came on, and to some extent Aspas as well, like, almost kind of opened it up, and you just wonder if Herrero had maybe been a little bit more ambitious and got these players on earlier, because Diego Costa wasn't doing it, and David Silva, I can't remember the last time I saw Silva play so badly as that. And Iniesta looked like he was he looked like he was 33.
It just all fell apart. Yeah, it just all fell apart for Spaniards and the Russians, and ultimately as well, you know, as poor as Spain were, they also kind of shot themselves in the shootout as well. You know, like they as bad as they were, they still had a distinct advantage in terms of the shootout. They won the toss, they elected to kick first, they lost that advantage, and Akinfeev obviously is the hero. But again, Russia, you have to, this has been, you know, a difficult story to kind of get behind for obvious reasons. You know, they've put on a great tournament and all the rest of it, but you kind of have to, you know, ask serious questions. Russia were awful. You know, and it's not just people pointing a finger at journalists and go, look at all of you who said they were really bad and now they're in the quarterfinals.
They are really bad.
All of you are terrible journalists, you know, because everyone thinks the same thing, and then they're proving the chances of there being something else afoot here is relatively high. Even in their own country, no one gave them a hope in hell. So I think that's certainly one element in this why Russia won't win the game, in that they're not very good. And I think the kind of Cinderella story has to come to an end at some point. And I don't really think they have the players. I think that they've been involved in a couple of inexplicable results. The 5-0 at the start of the tournament, the victory over Spain. And, you know, I think that Uruguay gave a proper representation of what Russia are like. You know, it's kind of that's really where they should sit. And I think that Croatia will follow suit. I think Croatia will get the job done. And that's a really great Cinderella story, I think, is the Croatian one. You know, 20 years after 98 and they finished third. And they should look forward to another semi-final.
So what's your score? What are you going for?
I think, do you know what? I think that this could actually be, out of all of the quarterfinals, I think this could be the most one-sided. I think Croatia will do them 3-1.
Ooh, I'm going 2-1 for Croatia. So where we are now, in terms of looking at the last eight, top three players for the golden ball, Golden Ball's the best player, right? Golden Boot is the goal scorer. Let's give me your top three at the moment for the Golden Ball.
I think we're at a really interesting point in the tournament now, because I think the way of looking at you know, the best player in the tournament is the player who turns it on at key intervals. So, I mean, right now you would have to look at someone like Kylian Mbappe as someone who, you know, has given himself a really excellent chance of being voted that player if France, you know, get to the latter stages of the tournament. He's been a decisive in a really important high-profile fixture against Argentina. You look around at other players, you probably have to admit that Harry Kane, if England, you know, managed to progress past Sweden, England wouldn't have done that without him. He becomes obviously crucial at those big moments. I think Croatia, possibly you'd look at someone like Modric, you know, who showed immense character in the game against Denmark to step up in the shootout to take another penalty. I think you also have to factor in, a player like Neymar. I don't think that they, you know, somebody like him will be pushed to one side. I think he'll certainly be part of any conversation that's being had. I don't think he's had a particularly remarkable tournament. I don't think he's particularly set it alight just yet. Maybe there is a special performance or two in him from here on in. I think, how many is that? Maybe four?
I did my shortlist. I came to eight.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I'd be interested in. Oh, well, I think maybe one of the Uruguayan centre halves. I think that's been a big story. Oh, Cavani, maybe. Cavani because of the Portuguese game. But that injury may count against him. I think the Uruguayan defence has been a big story. So maybe a Godin or a Jimenez might make my list as well.
Well, we're pretty close here. What I've got at the moment, I've got Modric. And I've had to pick probably one player at the moment. It probably would be Modric. But I'd Godin or Jimenez as well. Like, I can't really. The playing combines so well.
It's a package deal.
I can't even separate them. Mbappe, you know, I think is one that comes to mind. But you know, if it and we know pretty much it's going to be an attacking type player that gets it, that's going to work against the Godin and the Jimenez. But if it didn't, then Kante would probably come into the equation as well for me. He's just I think he's been very good. Coutinho would be my pick out of Brazil so far. I say Hazard, but with some trepidation, because I just don't think he's played as well as he can yet. He's still been pretty effective, but I think he has got more, as does De Bruyne. But Hazard, I would suggest, is maybe there. Harry Kane, I don't think you can go past him. Granqvist for the Swedes, and Akinfeev for Russia, if they went on as well, that'd be my sort of MVP for each of the countries at the moment.
And you've basically got a decent team of the tournament set up there as well, with a few tweaks come the final.
Yeah, throw in a couple of fullbacks and a little bit, you know, aggressive going forward there, but not too bad. So anyway, this is probably longer than we expected tonight, but we've covered the gambit. We'll just take a break and we'll be back with producer Luke right after this.
You're listening to Soccer Report Extra with Bobby McMahon and Owen O'Callaghan. Be sure to follow them both on Twitter. Links are in the show notes below. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to part three of the Soccer Report Extra podcast. And this is the time in the podcast we bring in producer Luke, our world famous fact checker. Luke, what have you got for us?
Well, I just checked up on Christian Rodriguez. He just is indeed fat. And I can tell because I also am what you would, I think you've described it before, Bobby, as barrel chested. So I am a barrel chested man. That was a way we used to describe, remember Ailton, the striker from Werder Bremen and Schalke.
Yes.
So yeah. that's my benchmark for barrel chested and
I don't know what kind of barrels you know about.
Well, they're about as tall as they are wide. So so Christian, I think Christian Rodriguez fits into that category slightly for Uruguay. Marcus Berg does indeed play for El Ain. But he actually spent 2000.
Dear me.
His biggest club, I guess, probably was Hamburg. He also played for Gothenburg at the beginning of his career, but he spent 2013-17 at Panathinaikos, where he scored 65 goals in 99 appearances. Ooh. And
so Marcus Berg scored that many fucking goals.
And he's only made 21 appearances for Al Ain, and he has scored 25 times for them in one season. So I'm guessing the level of play is not
quite the same. I'm sorry if Marcus Berg is ever listening to this podcast episode. Every time I've seen Marcus Berg play football, he couldn't hit a donkey's arse with a frying pan.
Yeah.
But I've got a question. Like, we know he's now playing in the Middle East, but where's his cool brother playing? Iceberg.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Sorry.
It's back to IKEA for you.
Yeah. And then we were talking about the Golden Glove Award. And yes. So sitting with two goals
smell
against...
The glove.
You've got Robin Olsen from Sweden and Lovri Kalinic from Croatia. But then you've also got Becker and Muslera with one goal against each from Brazil and Uruguay, respectively. So, I don't know. I think you'd probably have to look maybe there for your Golden Glove winner at this at this point.
The thing is, you know, you can have one of these games where you're letting two or three like Lloris did, and suddenly your Golden Glove, even if you go through your Golden Glove option, kind of gets blown out the water.
Mm-hmm.
Who won? It was Neuer won it in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Who won it in 2010?
So yeah, 2010 World Cup. Yeah, Iker Casillas wins the Golden Glove there, Bobby.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting when you look at, you know, you start looking back on the little trigger points. You look back after the group stage and you come up with a bunch of players and you go, well, he had a good tournament. But the reality is, you've got to get to at least the semi-final.
Mm-hmm.
To be in with the awards chance, unless you get a kind of Salenko situation in 94 when he scored 5 goals against Cameroon and Russia didn't qualify.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty unusual, but you really usually have to go pretty deep into the tournament to be able to walk away with one of these awards.
Agreed. That's all my notes.
Well, anyway, so now this is the end of the Soccer Report Extra podcast, the World Cup round of 8 quarterfinal edition, and we will be back next week. We hope you can join us. Until then, thanks very much for listening, and hopefully get back together next week. For someone who's so keen to snuggle, you
cause a lot of trouble. Thanks for listening to Soccer Report Extra. To keep tabs on the podcast and get all the latest news, musings, and rants from Bobby and Owen, like us on Facebook at Soccer Report Extra. Music for this podcast graciously provided by Manitoba's hottest indie pop group, Misery Slims. Check them out on Spotify and YouTube, and follow the band on Facebook at Misery Slims.